Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. We come together on this sacred occasion to commemorate the silliest of all corporate holidays, Valentine's Day. Normally, this Hallmark-sponsored mandate to buy greeting cards and stuffed animals elicits from me only nausea and eye-rolling. Listeners will recall that our previous St. Valentine's Day acknowledgement was a celebration of cinema's greatest decapitations. But this year is different. What inspired this sudden change of heart? Well, dearest listeners, it's because the release date of this episode, which I've been looking forward to since last November, happened to fall on February 14th. If that's not kismet, I don't know what is. So go ahead, put on your most fetching hat, place the back of your right hand directly on your forehead, and prepare to swoon. On today's show, we're talking about my favorite movie of 2015, possibly my favorite movie of the decade, Carol. Yay! I know what you're thinking. This is different from all your other shows. How? I know. I often find ways of casually working Carol into these conversations. But again, today is different because it won't just be me drooling over the movie like a lovelorn puppy. No, today, believe it or not, the screenwriter of the film, Phyllis Nagy, is here to witness me drooling all over the film. This won't be embarrassing for me at all. And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the show, Phyllis Nagy.
Hello. Please feel free to drool. Okay. That's fine.
I'll try to keep the fangirling in check if I can. Phyllis is here to offer details on how she went about adapting Carol from the original source material, Patricia Highsmith's 1952 novel, The Price of Salt, and she'll hopefully talk about what it means to see Carol finally make it to the big screen. And in case that wasn't exciting enough, in addition to our discussion on Carol, we're also going to have a whole separate conversation about a pair of Isabelle Huppert films. Huppert has recently drawn a lot of attention for her portrayal of the lead character in Paul Verhoeven's 2016 film Elle. But today, we're taking a look back at two of her older films that Phyllis has singled out as deserving of greater attention: Claude Chabrol's 1988 film Story of Women and Diane Curie's, oh no, Diane Curie's 1983 film Entre Nous. But first, let's talk Carol.
No other love can warm my heart now that I've known.
Love is the subject of today's show. That feeling when you meet that special someone and all else in life starts to recede from your peripheral vision. The world's edges slowly dissipate until all that's left is you and them and the faint crooning of Joe Stafford. Or similarly, when you walk into a theater, the lights dim and Kate Blanchett starts flirting with Rooney Mara over a clandestine club lunch. And then there's a clip from Sunset Boulevard that's used to illustrate how subtext works in film, and you know deep in your heart that the filmmakers included that scene just for you. Ah, l'amour. The film to which I'm referring is, of course, the 2015 masterpiece Carol, directed by Todd Haynes and starring Kate Blanchett and Rooney Mara. Carol tells the story of two women in early 1950s New York who, after a chance encounter in a department store, form a kind of sublime connection that eventually blossoms into a romance. It's a simple premise made great by the extraordinary filmmaking talents of all involved. The acting, including the work of all the supporting players like Kyle Chandler and Sarah Paulson, who play Carol's respective husband and best friend. The production design, the score, the cinematography, all exemplify the strengths of cinema as a medium. Yeah.
Sure does.
Yeah. But none of it would be possible without the film's backbone, its script, and the tireless efforts of the screenwriter, my guest, Phyllis Nagy. All right, so I just want to say I really like the movie. Thank you for making it. Did you have any idea what the reaction was going to be as you were writing it or while you were in production? Did you sense that you were making something really special?
Well, not necessarily while you're writing it, and because Carol had taken such a long time to get from first draft to shooting, one can get rather jaded about its chances to be any good. Not that it had been through the development hell that, say, one might encounter here in within a studio system. It wasn't like that at all. I had a very free hand in shaping the script and revising it, and I had a long time to do it. But I just lost sight of the fact that it would ever be made. I didn't think it would be. And so finally, when it was in production, it was the first inkling I had that maybe we were making something extraordinary. I was watching the scene with Kate Blanchett, Kyle Chandler, and all of her lawyers being shot. And I noticed that everyone around me, in Video Village, everyone, including, you know, big grips and very macho guys, were just crying. And I thought, wow, okay, if this, watching this tiny little screen, and Kate, of course, is extraordinary in it, one was take after take, maybe, just maybe, this has something to offer beyond our own edification.
Yeah. Yeah. So walk me through the very long journey from page to screen. How many incarnations did the script have?
The draft that was shot was the fifth draft. That's over 18 years. A couple of those drafts were getting it back to the first draft. I mean, it's always the first draft with some key revisions, you know. But basically what we shot was a lot closer to what I wrote in 1999 than it was to, I'd say, the middle years. What tends to happen is that if there's no traction on a film like this, the producers can't attract finance, whatever the case may be. The script is the first thing that's looked at. I won't say blamed. It's more like an automatic tick. Well, maybe if we did this, more people would be interested. And also the kind of what I think is an awful tradition. If you give a script to five directors and five of them say, well, I don't know, maybe it'd be better if this woman suffered. That's often taken as a valid criticism of something. It could be anything that they're talking about. And I think that's wrong. What I would say, and that didn't happen with Carol, but I would say, well, perhaps you haven't given it to the right actor, the right director, the right, you know. If we think this is good, why? But so we had a couple of moments of that. But the constants along the way were Tessa Ross, who ran Film 4 and built that company up into what it is today, who was always a support, who, when she took over Film 4, had to buy back Carol because a previous person had let it go. And she also had to buy back Mrs. Harris, which was commissioned in an earlier regime. And so she was a great supporter, not only of Carol, but of me. And I think pretty much made sure that even if there was a moment when I didn't want to continue with it, that I was going to continue with it, kicking and screaming.
Yeah. You were friends with Patricia Highsmith, correct?
I was.
Yeah.
Over the last decade of her life, so she died in early 1995 on the night, oddly, on the night that the play I dedicated to her opened. She died on that very night. Bless her. She was always into upstaging.
Yeah.
And we had talked about the possibility of me adapting something that she wrote. More at that stage, I think, She was being kind and encouraging. But as our friendship developed, my career in the theater took off and people in movies started talking to me. Carol, which she had retitled Carol while I knew her from The Price of Salt, wasn't one of those books that she thought anyone would be interested in or should be necessarily. Mm. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
It was 5 or so years after she died that, 4 years maybe, when the original producer of Carol approached my agents and asked for who should do this.
And makes sense, yeah.
Up I came.
Yeah. Was there anything, what was it specifically about Carol that drew you to the project beyond its association with Patricia Highsmith?
Well, because it was the first piece of work of its kind that I'm aware of, and I think this is still true, that not only did it have a reasonably happy course of action for its protagonists, but crucially, it never allowed them to suffer a moment of guilt over their choices in regards to their sexuality. I've heard people recently talk about how a film like, say, Desert Hearts, or even that book, was that, but I think that's different. And the kind of radical notion that Patricia Highsmith had about what it means to be a good mother, those are the things that really spoke to me, apart from knowing quite a lot about Pat's own past and how this connected to the things that she was doing when she was a young shop girl temporarily. So yeah. I felt I had to, really.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You mentioned her attitude towards motherhood, which while that aspect is present in the book, I think you've really emphasized that element in the script with the speech that Cate Blanchett gives, the soliloquy
yes.
that she gives towards the end of the film regarding, you know, she can't go against her own grain. It's in the same spirit of the book, but it really, really highlights that theme. And I just kind of want to talk about other ways in which the script diverges from the book in some very dramatic ways, some very key ways, and some somewhat minor ways. I don't know that it's a huge deal that Therese has different jobs in the book and the script, but I think that was really effective.
Yeah, I think it's a huge deal for the film.
Yeah.
I mean, I hear from Carol fans with some frequency, some of whom are just passionately devoted to the fact that she was a theatrical set designer or, I don't know, many others, that the portrait in the book, which everybody seems to be really taken with. And I always try to explain that for a book to translate to film, you have to understand the notion of a temporal reality on screen and what the actual visual narrative will be, that there's very little actually that can be taken from that novel and just put up on screen. Mm-hmm. There's virtually no dialogue from the book. I put in Flung Out of Space, but what makes me happy is that I've enabled people to think that it has come from the book. That's fine if that means the dialogue is specific and right to the period and the time and the characters. Similarly, the plot, which is always the least interesting aspect of any narrative, is almost completely different from the novel, and yet it's not. We eliminate the double road trip, which is quite major, and compress bunches of months in which Therese in the novel forlornly comes to terms with the loss of Carol. We lose. Carol is obviously not a major presence in the book, except in Therese's imaginings of her. And when she is around, she's rather cranky a lot of the time, mm-hmm. Like Pat Highsmith. But cat, oddly, was more of a Therese, you know, a watcher, a lurker. So it's actually completely different. And I had always asked people if they were really seriously interested in adaptation to read the book. I think there was an assumption made that it was a very faithful adaptation of this, you know, steamy romance novel. Well, A, it's not a romance novel. It's not even a romance. It's a crime novel, just like the rest of her work is. And B, it is utterly faithful to it and utterly different from what Pat Highsmith wrote, but her tone and her intent are completely obeyed, and which is what I think the job of adaptation really is. Mm-hmm.
Can you elaborate? How is it a crime novel as opposed to a romance?
Well, obviously what Carol and Therese do is a crime. Mm-hmm. There's no other way to say it. It is. At the time, it was a crime. It's adultery is a crime. And it's interesting the ways that Highsmith gets to write her crime novel. Todd used to like to say the crime was love, and yeah, that is true. She still gets to write it. The striking thing about this is that, and this may be a controversial thing to say, in terms of psychology, they're not so very different from Tom Ripley, but only in one key area. Highsmith, whose major obsession was guilt and the way that people deal with guilt, in her early novels, set out to write characters that were completely free of guilt in matters of moral importance, let's say. And so Ripley's lack of guilt about his crimes comes about as his refusal to deal with his obvious homosexuality. He would rather kill than be outed, which I think is one of the problems with a lot of the Ripley adaptations that I'm aware of. And in Carol, she goes the opposite way, which is that it is only the absence of guilt that can make them emerge out of the criminal element and into the sunshine. So it's a much more complicated novel than I think even its novelist gave it credit for being.
And another way in which it diverges is the book is almost takes place almost entirely in Therese's mind.
Yeah.
And in the movie, about I'd say two-thirds of the way through, we kind of switch perspectives and get Carol's side of the story. Why did you decide to make that?
Well, we would never, I mean, it was hard enough to get this financed, but if one is trying to make an ambitious mainstream-ish movie, which I think it's fair to say everyone involved with this was always going for it, not mainstream in a way that we ever thought we'd make $150 million. It wasn't about money. It was about a certain sort of profile for it. The moment you are able to attract actors like Kate, it takes on another level, whether or not you like it. And in this case, we had no objection to it. But you needed the kind of resources in order to do that. And you cannot write. And very few interior POV love stories work. The ones that Todd looked at, and things like Brief Encounter, fudge it. And so I always knew that a love story needed two flesh and blood leads, not one.
Right.
Otherwise, you don't trust anything she's saying. And in fact, she is quite unreliable in the book, quite selfish, quite weird.
Yeah, she's a weirdo.
She's a weirdo, Therese. And I'm not sure she's any less of a weirdo in the film, but she has a friend. She has a compatriot. She has a lover. You can see the difference between Carol and all the guys around her, and even the other women that are around her. Mm-hmm. And I think that counts for a film. You see it. You can imagine anything you want when you're reading a book.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think it's important to understand what the other love interest is thinking, right? Otherwise it's...
But that was a bonanza for me. I mean, that Carol doesn't exist except as a sort of Hitchcock slinky blonde in the book.
Right.
Was great. I can just invent her character. I didn't have a template that said this woman has to love her child so much that she sacrifices her love and blah, 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 blah. Like, no. In fact, the suggestion is the opposite, that she loves her child so much that she wants to make sure she doesn't grow up fucked up. And I loved that the men were undercooked in the novel because, again, and that was interestingly, the one fight. It's a little dramatic, but the one dramaturgical fight I had again and again with people, not with Todd, not with this team, but shouldn't they be either A, meaner, or more likely, more sympathetic? I'm like, well, but they're very sympathetic because they're empathy. You can have empathy for them because they're human. If your wife came home and said, I'm leaving you for a woman who's like a child, what would you think?
Yeah.
Would you be hurt? Would you want to get her back? We have a president of the United States who wants to get people back for saying his inaugural wasn't well attended. So spare a thought for poor Harge and Richard.
Yeah. I think that that's one of the real strengths of the movie, is that it demonstrates how when people are repressed and confined in certain roles, it ends up hurting everyone, not just those who are repressed or oppressed. It reverberates to all sectors of society. And again, I thought Carl Chandon did just a great job illustrating that.
Oh, he's marvelous. He really is.
Yeah. And I feel like we should probably talk about the performances. That's a good transition. We've talked about Kate Blanchett. I'm on the record as loving Kate Blanchett and Rooney Mara. They're both terrific. And I read in an interview you gave that you felt like you weren't sure what Patricia Highsmith's reaction would have been to this film, but you were certain that she would have loved Kate Blanchett's portrayal of Carol. What is it about Kate Blanchett do you think she would have loved?
Well, I mean, aesthetically, she would have been over the moon with her, not only because I think Pat would have fancied her. I mean, that Kate Blanchett looks and sounds like a lot of the women that I know Pat fancied. But it's beyond that. It's a sort of stylistic thing. Pat's work and Pat herself was quite stylized and quite performative. And Kate has both of those things going on. She would have absolutely adored her. And I think she would have adored Rooney's odd channeling of her. She was a lot like Patricia Highsmith.
Really? How so?
Yeah. She had no idea. I mean, but her the way she carried herself in the film, her bizarre way of a sort of a halting, slightly hyper-real delivery of lines. And the way she could take a line, this is pure Pat Highsmith. If she never said it to me, she probably meant to say it. Stuff like, well, somebody, a friend of mine told me I should be more interested in humans. But the way that Rooney says that makes it sound perfectly ordinary. It was sheer Pat Highsmith. Mm-hmm. She would say the most astonishing things and really? Yeah.
It's deliberate.
And Sarah Paulson, of course.
Sarah Paulson.
As Abby.
We must talk about Sarah Paulson. Yeah. I have one final, I'll save that for the last question about my question about Abby. let's back to the script and the process of adapting the novel. So much of Carol and so much of the story and the relationship is, and the development of the relationship is nonverbal. The audience needs to take kind of cues from various gestures and other ways of suggesting that there's a romance blooming. How did you go about writing a script that where you couldn't really rely on where you couldn't rely on the dialogue necessarily to convey your story?
Well, I mean, it's so interesting to me. I would hear that a lot, and I would say that that's not actually true, that it completely depends upon the dialogue to convey. It's just not literal.
Yeah.
It's full of subtext. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just take the diner scene alone, the lunch scene where they go. And if you don't, maybe if you've never been in a situation where your first date with someone, I think everyone's first date is like that. Perhaps they're not as, you know, elegant as Carol or Therese, and they don't have cream spinach and poached eggs and martinis, but you know when someone is flirting with you. And it's not because they say to you, "I think you're hot," when Carol says, "I'm starved." On and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's great that people think Carol is very nonverbal,
mm-hmm.
because, of course, there is that also level that's going on, as it does in every good love story. But I think what maybe happened is that every single element of Carol is working together so well. And Carter Burwell's score and Ed's cinematography, that like it is, it's the script that just gets bumped down to the end of the list because it's not immediately visceral in the same way that a great shot or a hand on a shoulder is. But I think it's a testament to the strength of the film that people get that its subtext is mm-hmm. kind of wafting through every moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's full of dialogue. And it's not, I mean, of course I would say this, but it's not full of unmemorable dialogue either. So it's not the key. I mean, plot and dialogue are recessive when something is working.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean that they're not there or responsible.
Right. I mean, there has to be a certain synergy between the script and the director and the performer to know. So Kate Blanchett knows when she says, "I'm starving," she doesn't literally mean "I'm hungry," you know, I want food, you know. And I think that's really where the film succeeds, is that on every level, everyone seems to be making the same movie. Everyone seems to be on the same
page. Everyone seems to know that. Even Kyle saying to Therese, "How do you know my wife?"
Mm-hmm.
He just knew mm-hmm. what that is. Now that comes because everyone's on the same page and Todd's discussions with them and on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's maybe, I don't know, maybe it's rare. Is it that rare for everything to be firing on all cylinders that, maybe.
Maybe. I think.
I don't know.
It's not something that I see that often in contemporary film. Maybe I'm seeing the wrong movies. I think to have the kind of trust in the audience that is required for something like Carol, I think, is rare.
Well, there's also increasingly, I mean, ironically, this is not true of either one of the French films we'll be discussing, but they were made in the 80s. And I haven't watched that many foreign language films to compare it to now. I mean, obviously I've watched some, but there's a fear of subtext and a misunderstanding of what subtext is, in my opinion, as I watch film after film after film, that subtext is not, you see a scene that's a love scene, and the people are either talking about how attracted they are to each other, or it's a steamy clinch scene. And to me, that's not what love scenes are. I mean, I think here's a hot take. I think Hitchcock shot more love scenes than any other director who was working in America that I can think of. For film after film after film is full of love scenes, and that's where I'll leave it.
Okay. I'm going to have to think that one over. Hang on. Okay. Well, let's, speaking of directors, let's talk about Todd Haynes. Mm-hmm. Love that guy.
Yeah.
Were you terrific. Yeah. Were you a fan of his work prior to working with him on this project? Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this was his first, the first film he directed that he did not, for which he did not write the screenplay. What was that? What was it like to work with him as a screenwriter?
Mm. Well, I think, you know, I think he'd worked, it's the first film. I think properly it's the first film that he didn't write at all. But I think over the years, he has worked with other people. He worked with Oren Moverman and on I'm Not There, John Raymond on various things, and Mildred Pierce. And so I think he has worked with people, but probably from the beginning. I mean, I've never asked him about how that worked. This is the first time something has been presented to him. And, you know, like with any other, as with any other director, they all have their points of entry. What is it that really interests them in a particular piece of work? Apart from the fact that Kate was attached to this, which was like a gift, and they loved each other. And so that was fine. We share a similar belief about a certain sort of restraint that was necessary about this. And there's restraint in the writing, and so he responded to that. Todd is always inspired by other films. I mean, it was fascinating to me because, there are other directors that I've talked to and they're purely inspired by paintings or photographs or literature or something. And Todd's frame of reference is about film. And so very early on, he talked about his desire to maybe see if we could have a framing device, a la Brief Encounter. He'd been watching all of these POV subjective, more as subjective as you can come, love stories from earlier periods. And so I said, you know, what if we took this scene, which had always been written, this scene in the bar where Carol says, I love you, and then that person comes in and says, you know. So that scene had more been written, and right before Therese goes off to her party, that scene happens. So I thought, well, what if it was that scene? And then the real writing or structural trick was deciding exactly where they were interrupted. Mm-hmm. And that was that. I mean, I put in back some things from earlier drafts for him, but it was really, and a little bit of this and that. But as far as that went, it was the framing device that was the dramaturgical contribution. And he was very easy to work with. We worked very quickly. We spoke, we traded emails. And it wasn't a big, you know, wasn't a big deal at all. It was because we are simpatico about things that matter, or even stylistically. Although I think I'm a more willing to push the boat out in terms of some outrageous moments or humor or, you know, that kind of thing. But it was a very happy experience. Mm-hmm. And it should be a model for how people work together.
Yeah, and you shared cultural points of reference. You mentioned Brief Encounter. Were there any other materials that you drew from to write the script in the first place, or then maybe upon revisiting?
No, not to. Well, I made sure that whatever I was doing, I'm a I often write music, source music into my scripts. They tell you you're not supposed to do that, but I don't care. And I always have, and I always will. But I did a great deal of research into that and just choosing songs. And then when Todd came on board, he and his partner, who knows a lot about music, popular music, did their own research. And I think the Joe Stafford tune and a couple of others that were always in the script, although it may have been in a different place, or I was glad that some of that survived. And I also wanted to make sure that the characters weren't either slavishly speaking in slang of the time, or that it wasn't so anachronistic that it was jarring. And that was the kind of thing I did. My only point of research ever for an adaptation is the novel. If it was a real event, I would do more, such as with Mrs. Harris, when I read every single page of trial transcript and things like that. But the novel is the thing.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think we covered just about everything I wanted to for this topic, except two things. Carrie Brownstein makes an appearance at the end of the movie. Is there more material?
Yes. It's interesting. There was the other thing that's good that you brought it up, because it was the other thing that Todd wondered about. And so I restructured a series of party scenes that happens at the end of the book and at the end of the film. Therese goes to this party. There's this woman there that she takes her number and agrees to go and meet her at another party or at her house or something. That's who Carrie Brownstein's playing. And what happened was, this is the vagaries of filmmaking. Todd told me this, so I'm not telling tales out of school. They shot those scenes like the last day, over the last 2 days of shooting. Everything was very rushed. I have no idea if they were over budget, but even if they weren't, they're probably being told they were. You know, it's like all of this stuff. A rush, rush, rush. And in, first of all, the structural device of chopping up those scenes and going back and forth to them didn't work. I never thought it would, but, you know. So I think the attempt was to put them all together, which is how they play. And then in, not focus group screenings, because they didn't have that, but Todd is someone who shares the cuts in progress. People were confused because Therese is not wearing the jacket that she wears when she's in the bar with Carol. So people didn't know if it was the same night or a different night. Or I'm serious. Like, this was one of the reasons. The other reason is that Todd said he didn't think he was able to spend enough time. He didn't get them in. And so most of it came out, which, I mean, it's fine. Of course, the movie plays and it's fine, but it's some of the best, it's some really good stuff. And, it also is Therese interacting with someone who finds her equally enthralling as Carol found her, and Therese making a real decision to go away. Similarly with Abby and the scenes with those three women. There were a number of scenes that can be found in the script, and they occur mostly between the moment that Carol asks her to go away with her, and when they actually depart on the road trip, Abby shows up at Carol's house that morning, Christmas morning, like she's been out all night and she's come to say goodbye. And there are scenes between Abby, Therese, and Carol, and Abby and Therese, which we all missed. I mean, I don't know. I never spoken to Rooney about it, but me and Kate and Sarah. But again, it's fine.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So you can't argue with it, but there, it's all about the women.
Mm-hmm. Any chance we can get those scenes on a special features disc
or
something?
I've been meaning to write to Todd and say, what are the plans for this? Because, you know, I know there's a, it was obviously the first DVD, but if there are special editions, yes, okay. We should.
Yes.
I mean, I've never even seen the party scenes, but I've seen the, I was there for the shooting of the other scenes, so okay. I know them.
Yeah.
Maybe they can all be restored.
Yeah.
I mean, deleted scenes.
Sure, yeah. I mean,
They're interesting, just anthropologically.
Exactly, yeah. I think that, again, I think the movie's basically perfect, in my opinion. But just be curious to see what didn't make the cut. Okay, I have one more question, but it's a silly one. So was there anything else that I didn't cover that you wanted to mention?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so I just want to know what happens with Abby and the redhead. Is that the sequel, the spinoff?
Poor Abby. I think Abby probably always has a thing for Carol and waits for Therese to peter out. But, you know, obviously we get asked about sequels all the time, and really what I've come to believe is you don't want a sequel to Carol. It's perfect as it is, and you don't want to know what happens to them in the rest of the 50s and 60s because it's not good. I mean, whether they're together or apart, it just becomes increasingly more difficult for women until, well, it still is. You
know. TBD.
But I mean, it's not pretty. Yeah. The early 50s were paradise compared to the late 50s and the rest of the 60s and 70s. I really think that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Why the early 50s?
Because there was still a lack of ability for men to name something like lesbianism. You can just skirt right under the radar. Increasingly, that wasn't possible. And when women became more, when they were starting to take some power, which they should, and lesbians becoming more and more open and protest and so on, which is all as it should have been, it also, strangely, became more difficult to live openly, especially if you were someone, I imagine, like Carol, who was the, you know, working at Christie's or something by that time. And Therese trying to wend her way through the New York Times, if you're going to follow that. Mm-hmm. I don't know what might have happened.
Okay.
And who would have become, you know, somebody throwing things at Stonewall or not. I don't know.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, you're right. It's better this way. We can imagine whatever we want.
And in this way, they can always be together.
Right. Exactly. All right. That's a good note to end it on. Okay. Time to talk Isabelle Huppert. The renowned actress just recently landed her first Academy Award nomination for her work in Paul Verhoeven's 2016 film, Elle. How is it the first? I don't know. We'll have to stay tuned to find out if she gets lucky on Oscar night. But honestly, at this point in her career, Huppert's immense body of great work should just speak for itself. She's been working steadily since the early 1970s, building a reputation as one of the world's greatest living actresses. There are so many treasures in Huppert's filmography, one hardly knows where to begin. But fortunately for listeners, Phyllis and I are going to offer up a couple of suggestions of Huppert's lesser-known performances that we think deserve greater recognition. First, we have Claude Chabrol's 1988, Une Affaire de Femme.
Very good.
or as I'm going to refer to it, Story of Women. In it, Huppert plays Marie Latour, a woman living in German-occupied France during World War II. Her husband is away, presumably fighting Nazis, but as is made clear later in the film, he's more likely off somewhere just being useless. While he's gone, Marie must find a way to support herself and her two young children. Not content to just make do with discarded potatoes from abandoned farmlands, she becomes a black market guru, primarily selling abortions to local prostitutes, or really any woman who needs one. She doesn't judge. In fact, she hardly thinks twice about the morality of her business, and perhaps more importantly, the legality of what she's doing. How can she when the money keeps rolling in, and with it the promise of a better future? Of course, I won't reveal what happens in the end, since I imagine many of you have not yet seen the film, but suffice to say, the gravy train comes to a rather abrupt halt. While this film was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Foreign Film, it isn't often ranked among Chabrol's most widely seen works, but today we're hoping to change that, maybe inspire a few of you to pick it up. So let me just start with how this whole topic came up. I asked Phyllis to send me her list of favorite films, and this was included among them. And it was, I must admit, one I had not yet seen. So I'm really glad you suggested it, because I'm really glad I watched it. So maybe tell me how you came upon this film and why it resonates with you so much.
Sure. I saw this film along with the other Au Pair film that was on my list of neglected classics, let's call them, in New York when I was probably even too young to fully appreciate it. But what struck me and what drew me to the film initially was the very interesting story of how it couldn't get distribution in this country. So much so that its producer actually set up a distribution company to distribute it in America and probably North America. Of course, by that time, I had seen Au Pair in Entre Nous, which we will be discussing as well. And I had quickly gone through whatever back catalog of hers I could find. But then when I went to see the Chabrol, who is a director I also love, and she had worked with before on Violette, I came to Story of Women expecting to love Isabelle Huppert and whatever work Chabrol had done. But this film, for me, took her into another territory of acting. And I would say it's arguably the first film of Huppert's that defines what's now known as her style, which is this unsentimental rendering of, rather unsentimental characters. Some would say unlikable, but Marie Latour, I think, is eminently understandable.
Mm-hmm. I think when we were watching Entre Nous, which we're going to get to in a few minutes, you called her a sociopath, which I think is apt. Yeah, she's sort of, she withholds so much. It seems like that's the key to her, to her mystery. And her face is inscrutable almost throughout. I guess at the end, you know, she's properly...
Well, I always think about her as, you know, my great loves baseball and movies, really. If I were asked to form an expansion acting team, like here's a new team of actors, Isabelle Huppert would be Clayton Kershaw.
Okay.
I mean, like a good, like a great pitcher. Mm-hmm. Great baseball pitchers are as withholding as great actors. Mm. And it's in the very withholding that you see the interplay of all the emotions coming together in one shot. And I think that these two performances, Story of Women and Entre Nous, are her great early performances, period.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like it. So you recently met Au Pair.
I
did. Can you tell that story?
Oh, wow. Well, I was at the Film Independent Spirit Awards nominee brunch and catching up with friends and chatting. And in a corner, I saw Isabelle Huppert standing with Maren Ade, or I don't know if that's how she pronounces her name, and Sandra Hulert, from Tony Erdmann, another film I very much admire. And I said, I've got to go. I was like, I was in the middle of this intense conversation. I was like, excuse me. Finally, I said, excuse me, I'm going to do this. I said, but I just can't walk up to Isabelle Huppert. And the person I was with said, you bet you can. Just, you know, go. You've got something she doesn't have right now. I thought, yeah, you're right. I go. And by the time I got there, unfortunately, the Tony Erdmann people had flitted over, but she was there. And she looked at me and smiled. And I said, I just wanted to say, I think you're amazing. And your work in L and in Things to Come this year, that is a film which I think she probably ought to have been nominated for. But that's another story.
Okay.
What's her name? Mia Hansen. Yeah. But anyway, she had that regal, glacial look that most actresses perfect for PR people, for press, for whatever. And she said, oh, thank you very much. And she said, who are you? I said, I'm Phyllis. And it just eyes glazed over. And I said, I wrote a film called Carol, and there was this little pause, and she said, oh, you wrote Carol? Yes. Oh, I love that movie. And the discussion then became all about Carol, which was great. She was funny, warm, not at all like her persona in her great roles. Mm-hmm. And I wished her well with the crazy circus, and that is the American award season. And she laughed and said, mm-hmm. And we just, you know, I mean, it was one of those encounters that I thought was perfect. It was the right amount of time. Right. And we both went off to have similar encounters with others at this place. Yeah.
All right. Well, back to the film at hand. We should talk about Chabrol. Were you a fan of his work in general?
I was. I mean, what's interesting to me about Chabrol is I think he made some of his greatest movies in the 90s. And beginning with Story of Women, made a series of films, often with Huppert. So by the time we get to La Cérémonie, which I think is for me my favorite, and this, but it features another astonishing Huppert performance, but in that film it's matched by her co-star, Sandrine Bonnaire, adapted from probably my favorite Ruth Rendell novel.
Okay.
A Judgment in Stone.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that movie, fascinating.
Yes,
I think
absolutely.
That, yeah, that's a great one. But we should say, for those who are unfamiliar with Chabrol, he started, I think he made his first movie in 1958. He was sort of one of the primary founders of the Nouvelle Vague movement, funded some of the great works that we now know of as classics, and by Godard and Truffaut and the lot. But he's sort of if the French New Wave gang are the Beatles, he's kind of the Ringo or something.
I guess
he is.
Yeah. Although he's my favorite of them.
Okay.
Because he's interested in narrative in a way that the others are not, generally. He's not interested in children. He's interested in messy adults. He's even done a pretty good Highsmith, Cry of the Owl. And when he found Huppert, I feel like he found his actress level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also that worked for her, because previous to, I think Entre Nous is the outlier in the early 80s, late 70s. She'd been doing some very good work for some very good people, yet it was all very female in a traditional sense. She was a waif. She was a sexy person. She was all these things that are less interesting than what she later became in everything. And I think it started, you know, the scales went whoo, with Story of Women.
Okay.
Which is also one of the first films, along with Entre Nous, which had a script that was intensely subtextual. Just Story of Women, apart from being beautifully acted by everyone, including the poor tragic Marie Trintignant as the prostitute friend, Lulu. This is a beautifully written film. And perfect example of how to write subtext. She, early on in the film, the way that Marie Latour gets into performing abortions, it's her friend, Jeanette is pregnant with, you know, her 8,000th child. And she, Isabelle comes across her, Marie, in a mustard bath, and she doesn't know what the hell it's for. And they get around to saying, you know, Jeanette says, well, Bernard doesn't want it, her husband. And Marie looks at her and says, I've come for the coffee mill. You know, that's beautiful. And I think it's not unfair to say that the entire script is structured like that. Jeanette says to her, maybe your husband will come back. A new pair looks at her and says, well, you won't get rid of it that way with mustard. Immediately, you know, she doesn't want her husband to come back.
Yeah.
It's rare that you get, and you would never get a script like that here, or rarely. Mm-hmm. You'd have to be quite powerful in order to do that. But that's that script for anybody interested in writing, quite apart from the au pair love. And it's a beautiful example of how to handle material that's based on actual people. Because Marie Latour, of course, is based on a woman named Marie-Louise Giraud, who we won't say for those, but in Vichy, France, she was became quite symbolic. And the film's examination of hypocrisy during the Vichy regime, again, also, towards the end, it becomes not literal, but more overt. But there's a wonderful scene where Marie and her lawyer are speaking about what's going to happen potentially in a room, and the only prop, apart from tables and chairs and a guard, is a photograph of Marshal Pétain that's hanging just behind them as the symbol of everything that's wrong with Vichy France. Also, this has it's strange. I watched this again recently to prepare for this, and it has strange parallels with Entre Nous and a sort of an odd, restless, not quite defined sexuality that au pair has in both films.
Do you think that's kind of just a manifestation of au pair's persona and that, like, that sort of inscrutableness? Are we projecting this restlessness onto her, or is it?
I think it's both. I think it's part, it's obviously it's part of both Entre Nous and there is a suggestion in Story of Women that things might have gone differently if her friend Rachel, who is a Jew, and au pair didn't even know that, Marie doesn't even know that, if she hadn't been yanked away,
right,
things might have been different, let's just say.
Mm-hmm. That's initially where I thought it was going.
Well, also, what's interesting thematically in the Story of Women is very early on, there's a scene with au pair and the character who plays, I don't know who that actress is, plays Rachel, but they're dancing in a pub, and au pair tells her she has angel eyes, which becomes quite a thematic thing, and interesting because what people euphemistically how they referred to abortionists was, let's see if I could get it right, faiseuse d'anges, the maker of angels. And of course, Rachel is clearly an angel by the time Marie meets her own destiny. But this notion that she is a maker of angels in some way with these aborted fetuses. But also the laws surrounding that in Vichy France were quite interesting and complex. And anyone who's interested in what it was really like from a legal standpoint in the occupied territory of France should watch this, because I've never seen a film that quite addresses it in this way, as a sort of part condemnation and part attempt to understand what the collaborationists were up against, mm-hmm. more or less.
Yeah.
But at the center of it is this very clear-eyed performance by Huppert, playing basically an illiterate woman, and that is so difficult. She doesn't make one single expected choice, not even when she starts to pray, and you think, okay, here it comes, and it doesn't. Mm-hmm. In fact, something quite other occurs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When we talk about the rest of Chabrol's work, I think of a lot of emphasis on sort of satirizing or even critiquing sort of bourgeois values. And yet here, this whole movie is about this poor woman striving for this middle-class life. And yet he doesn't condemn her for it. He doesn't judge her for it. Why make the exception here?
Well, although is it? Because what happens to her is she is as the character becomes more, as her husband, who was in a work camp. The Germans sent French able-bodied men, and he comes back not able-bodied, and in fact is so humiliated that he has to he shits his bed. You know, he can't work. And they have two kids, the boy child of which she doesn't treat well at all, but the girl child, who is actually played in later scenes by her own daughter, Huppert's own daughter. Her undoing or her unraveling occurs because she invites every single one of her vices into her own home at once. And the husband, who she thinks she's taking care of in odd ways, there's kind of extraordinary things that occur. Mm-hmm. She basically believes that everything can be solved transactionally because she's been so emotionally cut off, and that's our undoing. Mm-hmm. But there's a point of connection that I wanted to, before we forget, bring up between the story of women and Entre Nous, and that's the actor who plays her husband in Story of Women, François Cluzet, is in Entre Nous as the soldier on the train.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
All right, well, we'll get to that. Regarding, I just think it's interesting, Chabrol's relationship to music and how we mentioned La Cérémonie and how central music is to that film. And again, we see that here, where her initial payment for that first abortion is a record player. And then at the end, it's
she wants to be a singer.
Yeah.
That's all she's ever wanted to be. And she's not very good, and it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
We're told she could be good, but I'd always wondered if it's something that people say to be kind. No one's ever kind to her, particularly mm-hmm. in this film, except for the music teacher and the her prostitute friend. Mm-hmm. I think the husband tries to be kind, but I wonder how much of that was invented and how much that was particular to Marie Latour, Marie Giraud. Certainly in looking at pictures of Marie Giraud, she looks like she might have been a kind of woman to want to be a singer. Mm-hmm. But basically that whole thematic aspect of it, it's sort of what Florence Foster Jenkins should have been. And those who have seen both movies will know what I mean.
Interesting. Okay. It's interesting to bring up Meryl, because they're so, I don't know why, but they're so, Hubert and Meryl are so often compared, often Meryl unfavorably, which I don't think is
That's not fair.
Yeah.
That's really not fair.
Yeah. Why must we pit them against each other?
Well, I think Hubert has made probably more films than Meryl Streep. But I think we have to consider that what we've seen of Hubert here, and it's quite a lot, is the best of Hubert. And we see everything that Meryl has ever done, mm-hmm. probably.
Right.
I mean, can I think of an unreleased Meryl Streep film or like something that was just swept under the carpet? Not really.
Yeah.
And I think they're very different kinds of actors, mm-hmm. too. One not better than the other.
Exactly.
I can't think of a direct point of comparison. In terms of an American actress or even a British actress to Hubert. But she, I've seen her on stage, actually. Mm-hmm. She's every bit as interesting and good on stage, mm-hmm. which isn't something that you can often say about people who are primarily film actors.
Yeah, I'm surprised that her approach to acting translates to the stage, because so much of it seems to be about reading the enigma that is her face.
Well, I saw her. I mean, it was fascinating. I saw her in a production at the National Theatre in London of Mary Stuart, and she was playing opposite, you know, great dames of the British stage, you know, Eileen Atkins and Harriet Walter and various people. And her style couldn't have been more different. And it was at a point in time where her English wasn't as good as it is now, let's say. And yet, you just couldn't take the difference in approaches. Mm-hmm. Was startling, and she was fearless, and it didn't matter. I sort of wish she'd do more narrative-based theater. She's come away from that, apart from her foray into doing The Maids with Kate. Mm-hmm. And she's been doing this touring with various versions of Phaedra. And I just... It's like, do a play,
yeah.
Please.
Okay.
You know, just please come back and do.
Yeah. Isabel, if you're listening.
Isabel, hi, it's me.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's going to go, yeah, right. Yeah.
So this podcast usually covers the Sight and Sound list.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's a Chabrol
film. Is there a Chabrol on Sight and Sound? Really?
No. Which is...
See, that's
bizarre.
That's really bizarre. Yeah. And... I would actually, I don't know how they put those lists together and what the criteria might be. But in terms of everything working on all cylinders and in level of, you know, difficulty mm-hmm. and importance, I'd say that this is the one that it should be mm-hmm. on that list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
More than La Cérémonie, which I love, but this is key film.
Yeah, especially looking back and thinking about seeing this when it was released, I can only imagine it must have been so striking, and I'm surprised it didn't have more of an impact.
Well, because I think, well, it did. It won a bunch of critics, mm-hmm. but because of the distribution, and the guy even had a hard time in France. So, you know, it's the whole issue of abortion, mm-hmm. the legality of what a government does when it's corrupt. Mm-hmm. Everyone should watch this film mm-hmm. because we may be seeing bits of it reenacted in our own country. And I'm not, I don't believe I'm being melodramatic about it.
I don't think
it.
You are either.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think maybe we should talk about that, the relationship between the criminal act and the way that these things are prosecuted, and that it's never about morality. It's generally just about covering their asses.
Well, there's an interesting story that goes along with, obviously the film does not get into this, but when the Germans came in to France and set up a partnership with occupied France, the magistrates, the existing magistrates, were all handed a sort of quota of convictions. And the penalties were predetermined. And what the Germans found was that real magistrates, people, real judges, it's just not really in them, practicing judges, to meet the quotas because punishment doesn't fit the crime or what have you. Anyway, then they set up these tribunals. It's like, that's not going to work. They threw them out and set up the state tribunals, comprised mostly of retired military and retired judges and businessmen. Sound familiar? And these people, like, quite enjoyed the pomp and circumstance of the roles. They liked the posturing and the staging. But you basically had military people, more or less, who were used to a very strict code of ethics, whether that was right or wrong, judging everything from, and everything that went before the tribunal was a state crime. So Marie Latour and her real-life counterpart being dragged before the tribunal was a travesty, certainly, but it all goes back to the way that the abortion laws in France were being, there was a law in the 1920s, I think, that criminalized it. Mm-hmm. But the extent to which abortion was made to represent the monstrosities of moral depravity when everywhere you turned, people, Frenchmen, were being deported to death camps and gassed. Mm-hmm. That is at the root of Chabrol's film. Mm-hmm. But it plays to me very much like a documentary right now. So watch it, people. Is it even available?
Well, if you have a Filmstruck subscription, it is available to stream. So there you go. Unlike our next topic. Finally, to wrap things up here today, we have yet another Isabelle Huppert performance we want to champion. This one comes from Diane Curie's 1983 French film Entre Nous. Once again, we return to wartime Europe for a tale of enterprising women. You'll be happy to know this time our heroine does survive the Vichy government. Huppert plays Lena, a woman who, during World War II, marries a man mostly out of expediency, and together they escape the Nazis. Once the war is passed, they manage to put a middle-class life together in suburban Lyon. However, the central pairing of the film is not that of Lena and her schlubby husband, but rather the relationship that develops between Lena and artist-turned-unhappily married housewife Madeleine, who's played by French icon Miu Miu. Are Lena and Madeleine just friends, or are they so much more? The film leaves that purposefully ambiguous, as there's no explicit physical love scenes depicted, but they definitely share a decade-spanning bond that sees them through the boredom and dissatisfaction of their loveless marriages. Together, they venture forth into a life of independence and maybe even happiness. Like Story of Women, Antoine was nominated for a bunch of fancy awards, including a Best Foreign Film Oscar nomination. But unlike Story of Women, Antoine is not readily available. As far as I can tell, it's not available to stream, and if you want a DVD, you'd better be ready to fork over $100, because that's how much it currently costs to buy a bootleg on Amazon. That's one of the primary reasons we're here today, to briefly discuss the film and to try and garner enough enthusiasm to see it put back in circulation. Okay.
All right.
Let's see.
Yeah.
No problem.
It's no problem. This is absolute madness.
Yeah.
That this film, this is an exquisite gem of a film that was greeted with huge praise upon its release from basically everyone. And it was the third film of Dion Curry's, who at that point was quite the hot up-and-comer. She had made two films which I'd seen, Peppermint Soda and another film. They were about adolescence, however. And this was about grown-up people
mm-hmm.
with grown-up problems. This is semi-autobiographical. It's about her own parents' marriage. And I think that the real-life equivalents of Lena and Madeleine did actually live together. But quite apart from any notoriety the subject matter might suggest, again, a beautifully made film with a stunning subtextual script at its center. So subtextual that a lot of the longing and desire is generated by the costumes alone. So if you're interested in aesthetics, this is clearly the film for you. And also marked by two stunning male performances, the two husbands of Lena and Madeleine are wonderfully relatable and empathetic, although I must say you'd want to leave them both too for very different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But again, Huppert playing a sort of provincial woman who... in the early days of World War II, gets put into is rounded up and put into a camp, work camp, where the cook, the sort of rather hirsute cook, catches her eye, and she agrees to marry him, and they let him go, and then she realizes he's a Jew, and she's pissed off mm-hmm. because they have to go
yeah.
to Italy. They have to make a trip to Italy,
right.
And it sort of bonds them in a way that they probably would have divorced within a few years. But that trip by foot,
yeah.
that's a
yeah. Once
that's
you've
a
made that
of
kind
trip.
Of commitment,
yeah.
you might as well stick it out.
she meets beautiful, doomed Madeleine, doomed because... an early marriage to, I suppose, the only person, the implication is the only person she loved, apart from Lena,
mm-hmm.
Doesn't go well, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And she's left picking up the pieces with her buffoon of a likable mime of a husband, Costa. And I just, you know, mimes, yeah.
yeah.
There's even a scene of mime in the film. Miu Miu, who at this point, and it's interesting, it was the first time she was a blonde sort of siren in a lot of her earlier films, and always playing a sort of disaffected, cynical one, perhaps because she's, quote, sharp-featured. So they always cast those women as the cynics. But this was the first time that she was playing the soft character. I mean... you would be
mm-hmm.
Compared to Huppert, right? And she went, you know, dark-haired for this,
mm-hmm.
which really, really impacted her career, apparently, in France. But it really worked to have her be the more rounded, soft, and fuzzy character.
Yeah, she seems the more idealistic character.
Yeah, or certainly the more troubled character. Mm-hmm. Whereas Lena, as always in Huppert's roles, even when she's playing the piano in The Piano Teacher, even when she's troubled, there's a strange practical urgency to everything she does. Like, this is perfectly normal, mm-hmm. no matter what I'm doing.
Yeah.
In Entre Nous, it serves the central relationship well, which is probably the longest courtship movie. That's a good way to put it. The longest courtship movie you'll ever see is Entre Nous.
Yeah. Not in terms of length, but in terms of the time that the film spans.
Yeah, the time that the film spans in getting its central characters together. Now, whether that means they actually lead a life as lesbians together, or whether they're just companions, I love that word, they're companions for the rest of their lives, mm-hmm. Independent of the kinds of relationships that have trapped them previously, doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Their love is the thing that nourishes them both, and when they're without it, bad things happen.
Right. Yes. Yeah. You have to watch the movie to find out.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the women's relationship with their children. I kind of love that was my favorite part of the movie.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Is how they address the kids. They seem almost indifferent. I mean, that could just be Huppert being Huppert, and maybe she loves them very deeply, or maybe she doesn't care at all. Who knows?
but. Well, I mean, they seem to me like normal mothers. Like, I remember when I was a kid, and I grew up in New York City, in not a great neighborhood at that time. I grew up on St. Mark's Place in the East Village, and in the early 70s and late 60s, it was actually like full of methadone clinics and junkies and strange people running around. And my mom and her girlfriends, who weren't even in love, you know, like Lena and Madeleine, mm-hmm. would walk together, and the kids, we would always be behind them. Mm-hmm. We were an afterthought, but in their hearts, they knew we were always safe. And yet in Entre Nous, that behavior has its consequences. Subtextually, of course, in that one glorious sequence where they forget about the one kid, you know, which leads to a crisis in Huppert's relationship with her husband.
Yeah.
But to me, the kids don't seem to suffer for it, which is the important thing. Mm-hmm. They're perfectly normal kids, right? The girl, who obviously is Curie's stand-in, takes it all in with her sad adult eyes, as does the boy in Story of Women. But it's interesting that these tales are told, basically narrated without being narrated, by the adult children of these women who gave their children rather interesting but turbulent childhoods.
Right.
The women in Entre Nous do seem to behave like ordinary moms. And so does Marie Latour, although it's hard to see that because of what she's up to.
Right.
Like when she says, oh, just keep an eye on Pierre, keep an eye on Mouche.
Yeah.
Pierrot is... her mom's going out to have an adulterous affair, or find another prostitute to take a room, or so it's difficult probably for some people to see that as normal, but it's just as my parents would have done.
Okay.
Keep an eye on your sister. I got to go run down to the store.
Yeah,
and I love that both of these films, but not Entre Nous in particular, normalizes women who are not constantly. I mean, I think films basically do motherhood a great disservice. And if nothing else, these two films do them a great service because at their centers, they're interested in what it means to be responsible to yourself and your children. It's mm-hmm. bizarre, but that's sort of how the way they work underneath the love story of Entre Nous and the how do I make a living, say, right. story of women.
Yeah. I mean, the remembrances are very different. The Entre Nous is almost kind of a nostalgic look back. It's not without the hardships or the difficulties. But Story of Women, the son, the narration at the end seems very cynical. He doesn't necessarily condemn his mother, but he certainly condemns what happened to her and the circumstances.
Yeah.
The nostalgic tone of Entre Nous is interesting because, as you say, the mothers do not dote on the children, and yet they still remember them. They are still remembered fondly in this version. And
at the end of Entre Nous is a series of really interesting, beautifully shot, wordless, quick scenes. It's not a montage. It's a series of quick scenes, which are about various people in isolation. The father and the daughter walking along the beach, Lena and Madeline, poor little Dion in the window, and even still life of fruit or veg or whatever. And it is as heartbreaking as the end of Story of Women, which, of course, relies on a really devastating line of dialogue at the end that the son has, which I won't divulge. But both of them question, obviously, what it means to be alone
mm-hmm.
or up against one thing or another in a society which doesn't value your relationships with other women. I mean, you could be said that Marie Latour, who frequents fortune tellers who tell her that there's a lot of women in her future,
mm-hmm.
that their primary relationships in these movies are with other women, not romantically, or not necessarily romantically, but in terms of compatriots and people who get you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and it's a very, both have very sly ways of reinforcing that notion that women really best understand other women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that men are the inscrutable ones and the ones who have too much 5 o'clock shadow. I mean, there are shots in Entre Nous where you just catch her looking at her husband and you know what she's looking at. Like, she is both fascinated and horrified mm-hmm. by things he can't help.
Right.
But she doesn't vilify him for it. It's more, I just don't get this.
I can't.
I can't.
Yeah. Yeah.
Same thing with the husband in Story of Women.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you get a sense from Story of Women that at one point she may have tried and has given up?
No. I don't think she ever did. I mean, I think Huppert makes such strong, bold choices from the start. There's never any doubt that she's actually glad he's not there. And it's funny, when she sheds tears in Story of Women, it's for herself or for Rachel. Mm-hmm. She cries for Rachel.
Yeah.
And she cries at a certain point when something happens with the kid. But it's always about her,
mm-hmm.
which I admire. I admire the bravery in that choice. Like, there's also, again, we can't really go into the details, but there's a scene towards the end of Story of Women, where she is on her own, just sitting in a cell. And she's got no dialogue to work with. because she's by herself and she's not going to talk to herself except in really crappy movies. But there's something she does, and it's all her. She, let's just say she touches her hair and her neck in interesting ways. Mm-hmm. That is like a masterclass in how to act. Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorite moments of any actor's work in any film I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. It's just extraordinary. And there's always at least one of those moments in an Isabelle Huppert film for me. That's it in Story of Women, but also in Entre Nous, they both are extraordinary together. But I would say in Entre Nous, it's her sitting on a train going to Paris, and her interaction, the way that she looks at a soldier, let's say. I just think, well, how do you pack that in to just a glance? Mm-hmm. What is it that you're doing? Is there some sort of, like, packed with God that you made that your eyes can just convey that?
Yeah, you always get a sense in both of these performances and in every pair of performance we've discussed today, that you're in capable hands and that every gesture is purposeful. And that, I think that goes a long way in conveying the meaning, and that, you know, you're looking for it too, you know?
Yeah. Also her work in Entre Nous with Miu Miu is an object lesson in how to be stunningly erotic without, having a single, overt sexual moment. Mm-hmm. I won't say there aren't sexual moments. There are, and they're clear. But they're not literal. They understand that sitting 4 inches apart on a bench is hotter than sitting thigh to thigh or sitting a foot apart. Mm-hmm. That there is that electricity that happens when you're in close proximity to the other woman's beautiful dress, mm-hmm. which is also part of what Entre Nous is doing. I rarely saw women ever walking around looking as good as those two. Huppert is the, for lack of a better word, more femme of the duo, and Madeleine with, you know, killer capris and beautiful flared hip-length jackets mm-hmm. and scarves. I guess artistes wear the pants, right?
Yes. All right. Well, I think we've probably convinced people to seek it out.
It's a beautiful, beautiful, emotional, restrained film. Lovers of Carol would really like this film.
Okay, I think you just sold it. Okay. Yeah. Perfect. And that's The Way We Frame It, FlixWise, that is. Listeners, have you seen either Story of Women or Entre Nous? Well, then I want to hear from you. Come leave me a comment on the website, flixwise.com, or you can leave me a note on Facebook at facebook.com/flixwise. And if you want to revel in the glory of Carol, I suggest you find me on Twitter. The handle is @flixwise. But before you do all of that, if you really want to do something special for me this Valentine's Day, skip the flowers and the chocolate and just go to iTunes, hit subscribe, then rate us and leave us a nice comment. And then if you really insist, I also accept baked goods. On our next show, we have a FlixWise favorite submission from listener Joshua Wilson. He's going to tell us why he thinks Blake Edwards' A Shot in the Dark is one of the greatest films of all time. We'll see. It's got George Sanders, so it's already ahead of the game, but I don't know. But until then, Phyllis, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's been an honor. It's been great.
And again, please, let's push whoever we possibly can to get Entre Nous back in circulation. All right. Happy Valentine's Day, everyone.